Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
Reparations, the racial wealth gap, and racial economic justice, conversations that America needs to have. We talk with members of Political Action Connecticut and find out it's not just about race or skin color, but lineage as well. Plus, a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. Racial disparities in America is just part of a wider conversation about race and racism in this country. The pandemic has shown how the black and brown communities in the US are being left behind once again when it comes to getting the COVID-19 vaccines. But of course, it's much more than that and goes way back to the times of slavery in the US. Although these conversations are happening, many say they are centered on race and skin color as a singular concept or minority status, when the importance of lineage is not being addressed or even considered. The Black American descendants of slavery are that unique group who say the conversations need to address them as well, whose ancestors were chattel slaves on American soil and who suffered through Jim Crow and systemic racism that followed. I caught up with three members of PACT, Political Action Connecticut, whose members are Black American descendants of slavery, to discuss these topics more. Joining me on Connecticut East This Week are three members of Political Action Connecticut. They are Shanice Austin, Tony Blount, and Jonathan Bryant. Thank you, all of you, for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So, a very important topic, reparations and the racial wealth gap and racial economic justice for the African American community in America. Shanice, I'm going to start with you because you and I started having this conversation, which has now led to this particular interview. How big an issue is this? And the organization, you know, Political Action Connecticut, why now?
This is the primary issue for Black America, America as a whole today, in my estimation. As we talk about equity, as we talk about justice, we cannot have those conversations without talking about reparations. And it needs to be primary. It needs to happen now. And so this is what our political agenda is. Political Action CT is a new organization. It's grassroots. It's really comprised of individuals who are part of different organizations coming together with one mission, one focus. Still developing, we're still forming, but this is the foundation of what we're trying to build is reparations for those of us who descend from American slavery. And that's a very important distinction that we have to keep at the forefront.
Jonathan, you know, help us out as well. Thank you for that, Shanice. I mean, what does this mean to you as well?
It means a lot to me. Me being a direct descendant of one of the first 300 slaves being sold in New London, Connecticut. So I have a very, very big history in New London, Connecticut, being a descendant of a slave. So I really take this to heart. It's very important.
And Tony, the same question to you as well. What does this mean to you?
In terms of reparations, I think it is the ending of a battle that has been going on for, you know, centuries. I think one of the biggest things that I try to press on people is that I'm American. Like, I can go back in my history. One of my cousins, generations back, fought beside John Brown at Harper's Ferry, Osborne Perry Anderson, to help spark the Civil War. I've had family members that have fought in both world wars. I've had family members that fought in the Vietnam War, in Afghanistan. And I say all that to say very often we as Black people feel like outsiders. But I think we have to understand that this is a land that we built. We are the definition of America, yet we have not been repaid for that yet. And we are still an underclass, and we are still stepped on by America in order for this country to achieve everything it has. So that deserves full repayment. You can't do patchwork type repair here and there. You have to fully make us whole so that we can enjoy all of the freedoms and all of the things that every other American does.
The other thing that's important to point out here, of course, apart from what you've, all three of you have just said, is that for African Americans in this country, I mean, you know, slavery started, what was it, back in 1619. If that wasn't bad enough, then also your own history has been like erased, wiped out in many circumstances, which obviously has made this battle, you know, even harder still.
Yeah, I agree 100%. You know, getting such a big part of all of this is educating first our own people to understand who we are, what the real history is, because it's not taught in schools. It's not, I mean, America, shoot, we're still trying to get the federal government to admit, you know, what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma with Black Wall Street and the Tulsa riots. And there's so many other incidents like this that our own government won't even admit, let alone teaching this stuff in classes and educating people. So there's that. And then there's educating the rest of the general American public, because they don't, sometimes people don't understand when we say things like white privilege. It's not that I'm blaming white Americans, the people that are here now. What I'm saying is, if you knew the history, you'd understand that you are only where you are because of the sacrifices made by our ancestors. And that should be taught. That's not just Black history. That's American history.
Let's just pick up on the Tulsa thing a little bit more as well, because that is actually little known and seems to have come out in the last few years. And partly due to the fact that, one, obviously history was suppressed, but also my understanding was that a lot of the people living that in that area were basically scared into never, ever mentioning it. So, of course, that was another problem as well, is that they were being, you know, repressed even there, being told, you know, you can't even mention this thing. I mean, it just seems absolutely incredible to hear that story.
I think that's the genius of oppression, is that Black people are, America is masterful at oppressing Black people's voices in whatever the movement is, whether it's the Black Panther Party speaking out. I mean, the Black Panther Party went to the Capitol in California, and they did so peacefully. They had weapons, but they were exercising their right. They were suppressed. Like, Black Panther leaders across the country are exterminated one by one. If you take a look at Ferguson and some of those early activists that spoke out, the Darren Seal, mysteriously, these people start disappearing. Black people have realized, because we are powerless, because we don't have the financial means, the legal means to protect ourselves, they can do whatever they want and tell whatever story they want to. So if you're people in this community in Tulsa now, even if you saw what happened, like half or more of your community was destroyed and killed. If you speak out, that could mean the rest of us destroyed. And that's what we always go through. Us speaking up could mean our extermination. And the rest of America pretends like it never happened.
So I just wanted to add to what Tony is saying. Tulsa, Oklahoma is one example. There are countless examples, both large and small, that has occurred across this country throughout our history here. One of the things that I'm reminded of when we think about when we had the insurrectionists storm the Capitol, the vision for me as a Black American was very similar to the stories that I've heard from my family about what has occurred and what occurred very, very often in their community. My people are from Pensacola, Florida, before we participated in the Great Migration of coming north for new opportunities back in the 1920s. And our family, although we have not talked about it, our family left Pensacola under very much the same circumstances of a mob mentality, of suppressing, of violence. And it's often not talked about. We hear some of the stories like Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Rosewood, and Florida, and other places, but it happened very much at a large scale as well as a small scale. And that's been throughout our history.
And Jonathan, just turning to you, I mean, you said at the top of this conversation that you're a direct descendant from slavery in New London, and we forget that it happened everywhere across the US. You know, nowhere was free of this at all, was it?
No, it wasn't. And I'm ashamed to say, I just learned this maybe a few years ago. And not only am I a descendant of one of the first of 300 slaves being sold in New London, Connecticut, but also, which was premise, his son Job also fought in the Revolutionary War. So to piggyback off of what Tony was saying, that, you know, we are American, you know, I mean, that's deep to be, to fight in the, you know, we fought in every single war this country ever had. You don't hardly hear about slavery in Connecticut. You know, it's not spoken of. Slavery in the North, period. So I just found it interesting that finding out my family history.
How do people react to that when you've had those sort of discussions? I mean, you said that you were ashamed to say you'd only just found out about it, but was that because of the way that records have either not been kept or been destroyed? You know, the way that information has just been withheld?
Myself, yeah, I think a lot of information was being withheld. But myself, I was lucky to be close to my grandmother, and she passed away when she was 95. So a lot of stories I did hear firsthand, but some stories she even refused to speak about, you know, like the farm she was on and how it got taken away from the family. A lot of untold stories. I'm still digging right now.
And Tony, I want to turn back to you. When we talk about, you know, reparations, I mean, what are we talking about exactly here? Are we talking about land? Are we talking about money? What sort of things are we talking about? And do we have any idea of a figure? Because I'm guessing we're talking in the billions, if not more.
Oh, yeah, we're talking a lot more than that. I mean, all of the above is the first answer. A reparations plan is not simply, but people have to understand that automatically think reparations means we're handing out cash to people that descend from slavery. That is part of it, but it's so much more, because not only are we talking about repayment, and there's a good place to start for people just trying to figure out about reparations, a book by Dr. Sandy Darity and Kirsten Mullen, From Here to Equality. That's a good place to start in terms of understanding different ways that it can possibly be calculated. Dr. Darity and Kirsten Mullen kind of go through different scenarios, whether you're calculating it based off of the wages that would have been earned, or whether you're calculating it based off the land that was promised near the end of the Civil War by General Sherman's field orders. There's multiple ways that you can calculate it. The figure would probably be somewhere between $12 and $17 trillion, but that is inclusive of not just cash payments, but programs to also ensure protection for all that happens afterward, programs to ensure that American descendants of slavery can secure home loans, start businesses, because not only are we talking about the cash, we're talking about a system that has been set up and laws that have been set up federally and statewide to prevent us from having access to resources. So even if you give that cash out, and let's say that cash was 800 grand a person or per family or something like that, it's only going to last for so long, because we've already seen there are plenty of Black Americans who are able to achieve wealth to a certain extent, but it's always reeled back in the next generation, because we got to come up against stuff like mass incarceration, educational disparities. So we have to be able to break past that part of the system. So yeah, it'll be a comprehensive plan with a lot of stuff. And from the perspective of America's pockets, it's going to hurt, but they can pay it, because we built this country for them to be able to do so.
We have a new administration now. What are your hopes as an organization that this administration will listen any more than maybe any other administration has in the past?
I mean, I guess I'll answer first. I'm going to be honest. I don't necessarily have any hope that they're going to answer, that they're going to do anything more than the previous ones. I don't think it's about them. I think it's about the people. I think it's about our people specifically understanding that we have to move as a voting bloc, and that we can't keep giving away something for nothing. Like, we have to decide, instead of letting politicians tell us what's important, we decide as a collective what's important to us. And then we tell them this is what we have to have. And then, at full disclosure, I didn't vote for Biden, nor did I vote for Trump. And the reason is because I will not give my vote away to someone who's already telling me they're not going to give me what I need and what I need for my children. So, you know, obviously there's always concessions. This is how politics work, but they have to come to the table. So I think we're going to have to make them understand that they don't have a choice, or they won't stay in the position they're in.
Shanice, let me turn to you. Getting back to obviously PACT, Political Action Connecticut, sort of what conversations has PACT been having with the administration here in the state?
I do want to quickly comment on what Tony shared. I don't want to miss that opportunity. Tony is absolutely right in that we can no longer operate under the notion of hope. We have to be very strategic on our political goals, and we have to outline our expectation of this administration and administrations moving forward. And so we are organizing and mobilizing. This is newer for us as a group. And so again, this is how we are moving. So in terms of PAC, what we're doing is we are taking any and every opportunity that we can with our political leaders to get our message in front of them. So far, we have met with, members of our group has met with the Lieutenant Governor, Susan Weisowitz. We have met at the local level. We have met with senators and state legislatures throughout the state of Connecticut. Our partners in New York, across the country have been doing very, very similar things. We're just getting started. We're getting organized. And this will be our agenda moving forward.
And do you feel that they're actually listening, though? I mean, that's the important thing, isn't it? I mean, they can be there. They can be in the present. But if they're not listening, I mean, are you getting a sense that they are listening and understanding what is being told to them?
I think part of it is we have to be willing to not give them what they need and what they want from us. So politics is an exchange. Our vote is not a gift. We need to be, that's the exchange. So the election has ended. There's a new cycle coming around at the midterm in 2 years, and then again in 4 years. So my sense of whether or not they're listening will really be determined as we move into the mid-year elections and into the next elections 4 years from now, because they're in office now. So they will listen as much as they would like to, but I want to see action. So, and we'll determine that as we move forward.
Jonathan, I want to turn back to you. I mean, here in Connecticut, we have seen more, and I use the word diversity, but it's not really that diverse, but we are seeing more people of color and from other backgrounds, you know, getting into positions in the legislature. How much more needs to be done, though, from that point of view to really get a proper balance?
Well, I think we need to disaggregate the people of color, because our claim is different and is specific to us, because ADOS, American Descendants of Slavery, we are the only group on this land that suffered multi-generational systematic oppression. Yes, other people of color do face prejudices and things of that nature, but our group, the descendants of slaves, it's for the survival of our group.
Let me put this question, obviously, to all of you, and we'll start with Tony, if I may, on this. Is anything changing at all out there for people of color, the Black community? Are you seeing any sort of change at all that gives you hope, or has nothing changed?
So I'll start with this. And, you know, this isn't a knock to you. This is more for your understanding and piggyback on what Jonathan just said. And I think one of the biggest things is for our people, we're recognizing that phrases like people of color do not work. And it is a way that the establishment has sown confusion about who we are and the uniqueness of our claim. So one of the biggest things, I'm seeing people waking up. I'm seeing more people who descended from slavery in America referring to themselves as Black American descendants of slavery, or I descended from slavery, or this is who I am, because it is so unique. And we have to understand that race is a construct. It's fictitious. It was created to separate us. That does not exist in reality. You can't look at people and say, oh, this person's colorful. They're a person of color. Like, some of those people we refer to as people of color can come from Jamaica. Some of those people can come from the Middle East. Some of those people can come from India. We cannot tie ourselves together by the fact that there is a group of people that discriminates against us. What we tie together is lineage, and that is specific to each person. And so for our people, the pride that we have started to build is we have learned who we really are, and that it's okay. We've lost the connection to Africa, sure. However, the connection that we have is that we built this country here, that we endured chattel slavery for all of the years that we endured it, and that's specific to us. So in any setting I'm in, whether it's an interview or whatever, I make that clarification that I am not a person of color. Like, I'm fine being called a black man, and I'm a black American descendant of slavery, but we gotta be specific.
Yes, just to piggyback off of what Tony was saying. Yes, we cannot, you know, lumping us together as people of color does us a big disservice, and usually, you know, the outcome of it, usually the black descendants of slavery usually don't get our needs met by having us, you know, all lumped together. As Tony was saying as well, you know, our lineage is what binds us together, and our lineage is special.
And Shanice, final thoughts from you.
And so to elaborate further, you know, I want to circle back to what you mentioned in terms of the number of people, and you use the term people of color, so I'll use that are now in political roles. That does not, having people of color or having black people in positions does not equal tangibles, does not equal legislation. And those are the things that we are looking for moving forward. So having, to answer your question, having a person of color, having a black man, a black woman in a position does not satisfy what we're looking for. We're looking for very specific legislation and policy. I don't want us to miss the point of why are we having this conversation now? And all of this is centered on the racial wealth gap in America. And that's where I would love for us to move forward in this conversation.
Well, Shanice Austin, Tony Blount, and Jonathan Bryant, thank you ever so much for your time so far. This is a conversation, as we all know, that has to be had. It is long overdue and will continue. And let's hope that we start to see some movement in the right direction. But in the meantime, I'm very grateful for the three of you coming onto the podcast today and sharing your views on this particular topic. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Anytime.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
And PACT asks that we add that while they are focused on specifics for the American descendants of slavery, they do welcome allies in other groups and are always ready to support their specific agendas.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently, sponsored by...
The Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling is a nonprofit organization which, through advocacy, prevention, and education, is here to support individuals and families who are impacted by problem gambling. Our helpline, 1-888-789-7777, is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We also have live chat and tech support through our website, www.ccpg.org.
The Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly and Senate Republican leader pro tem Paul Formica of East Lyme are calling on the Attorney General's office to investigate controversies at the Connecticut Port Authority. Formica says yet another CPA contract is creating public controversy and the Attorney General needs to act.
It seems pretty appropriate. There has been some public outrage as a result of this building over the last few years. So I'm hopeful that the Attorney General will make a decision that is in the best interest of the state of Connecticut and just, you know, open up the books and see what's going on.
The contract under question is an alleged May 2018 agreement with a subsidiary company of Seabury Capital Group, who managed the process of finding a new operator for State Pier in New London, which resulted in $700,000 in fees being paid and the new operator being Gateway, who already operate the port of New Haven. The Connecticut Port Authority is currently being investigated by the State Contracting Standards Board after receiving complaints about the CPA from local residents and companies. In the Connecticut Examiner this week, the state budget proposed by Governor Lamont calls for Connecticut to concede about $500 million of tax revenue, the majority from households earning more than $100,000 each year, in an effort to relieve the added burden of double taxation from as many as 110,000 tax filers in the state. These Connecticut residents in normal years would have commuted out of state to work mainly in New York, but had been working at home during the COVID-19 pandemic. Based on the current laws known as convenience laws, these Connecticut residents would owe income taxes in two states, for where their office is located and for where they now work each day. Even though it is a lot of money that we could use to balance the budget, we are doing the right thing in saying no, said Representative Sean Scanlon at a press conference recently. In the day this week, the former Seaside Sanitarium property in the town of Waterford, which has operated as a state park since 2014, is once again being looked at for a possible public-private partnership. State Senator Paul Formica has introduced a bill that requires the State Department of Economic and Community Development to develop and issue a request for proposals to develop or dispose of the former Seaside Sanatorium facility in the town of Waterford and to preserve the adjacent area for a park with public access. During a virtual public hearing conducted by the legislators' Commerce Committee, Formica said the legislation is meant to continue the years-long public conversation about Seaside. In written testimony, he said to walk the beautiful 30-plus acre property along Long Island Sound is to see the discouraging state of disrepair that has been allowed to happen these past 25 years of inaction under state control. Waterford's first selectman Rob Brule and Waterford State Representative Kathleen McCarthy testified in support of the bill. Both said they hoped for an affordable way to restore the sanitarium buildings for adaptive reuse while maintaining the surrounding state park area. In the Norwich Bulletin this week, utility poles, by their sheer numbers and convenient neighbourhood locations, have become de facto public bulletin boards where everything from lost pet notices to yard sale notifications are affixed. But attaching such missives to poles, usually with clothes snagging staples or nails, is a dangerous habit and could put linemen at risk for injuries or worse, according to local utility company officials. Eric McDermott of Norwich Public Utilities Electric Operations Integrity Manager said something as small as a tack jutting from a pole can cause a hole in a line worker's glove, boot or coat, putting them at risk of electrocution. They're working with high voltage and wearing specialized protective gear when even the tiniest pinhole can cause an issue with a layer of protection. The rubber gloves they wear are sent out and tested monthly because they're operating with a system of 13,000 volts. In the Middletown Press this week, the governor has nominated Robert W. Clark of Durham to fill a vacancy on the Connecticut Appellate Court. Clark has served as Governor Lamont's general counsel since his term began in January 2019, according to a press release. At the time, Clark gave up his position as a Superior Court judge to serve in his current role. And in the Chronicle this week, the cause and origins of a recent devastating fire that destroyed several buildings at the Hole in the Wall gang camp based in Ashford have not been determined but are also not believed to be suspicious. The investigation into the massive fire at the camp, which was founded by the late actor Paul Newman and opened in 1988, is ongoing. Ashford Fire Marshal Richard Whitehouse, who was working with personnel from the State Fire Marshal's office, said he still had people to talk to, but there was no reason to believe the fire was suspicious. And in next week's Connecticut East this week, we're talking sports and internet betting. As the new legislative session discusses these and other important state issues, we get the lowdown on what these types of gambling could mean for the residents of Connecticut, from the positives to the negatives, and the revenue it could generate for the state as a whole. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott-Smith. Thank you for listening.